So I've got quite a lot of material, so I'm going to rush through some of it a little bit. But I sort of didn't want to drop anything because they kind of hang together. So I'm going to start by saying something about what I think natural coins are. And that's going to tie into some of the things that people have said today, Francesca and Yanni in particular. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about something that we've had a little reading group on, namely the mind independence criterion for natural kinds. So I'm going to comment on that a little bit and present some problems with it. But ultimately, I think that there's an important element to this mind independence criterion. So I'm going to defend a version of it as well. And then I'm going to finish tying this thing back into the formal ontology and metaphysics of science, namely talking about how I think natural kinds and their properties are linked. And there's something to this title. I say natural kinds and their properties, because the thought here is that natural kinds are somehow prior to their properties. But in what sense exactly? That's going to be the business of the last slide. Okay, so let's get going. Good. So I'm going to put all my cards on the table to begin with here and say that I defend a strongly realist answer to the question of what natural kinds are. They are substantial universals. I'm going to say a little bit more about what I think that means in a little bit. But I'm not going to defend this idea as such. I'm going to work within this sort of neo-Aristotelian framework. So what does that mean? Well, it means, among other things, that natural kind terms may be thought to be a set of concepts, but we use those concepts to refer to the mind-independent, if you like, joints of reality. So natural kinds carve at the joints, if you like that sort of terminology. Okay, but the concepts, the terms, may carve reality to a varying degree of accuracy, of course, because they are concepts. So it doesn't mean that all natural kind terms, or what we think are natural kind terms, actually accurately capture the joints of reality. Because we could be mistaken about whether a concept successfully carves or not. And of course, a key question, and this is what I'm interested in today partly, is, well, what kind of things are good candidates for those genuine, real natural kinds? Okay, so the view, I call it a version of natural kind fundamentalism, because natural kinds are a fundamental in a perhaps yet to be specified sense. This is something that Yanni has talked about, categorical fundamentality. But they are a fundamental ontological category in a sense that EJLO means, and perhaps Brian Ellis, although Ellis has three different kinds of natural kinds in his ontology, so depends a little bit how you think of this. But what does that mean, that natural kinds are a fundamental ontological category? Well, I've got a quote here from EJLO's four-category ontology. He says, "What does it mean to describe a certain ontological category as being fundamental? Just this, I suggest, that the existence and identity conditions of entities belonging to that category cannot be exhaustively specified in terms of ontological dependency relations between those entities and entities belonging to other categories." So perhaps it's best to give an example, and this is one that he uses himself. So if particulars are just bundles of tropes or bundles of universals, rather than substances, then it would seem that you can give the existence and identity conditions of particulars just in terms of those tropes and the trope bundles and the relationships between those tropes. So then particular wouldn't be a fundamental ontological category in that sense. But I think that natural kinds are a fundamental category, so you can't give their existence conditions in terms of the other categories in this sense. All right, here's a familiar picture. The ontological square, which I think Yanni mentioned it earlier today from EJLO. I'm not going to be talking about this in any detail. I'm just giving it for reference. So for Lo, there's four of these fundamental categories. I'm interested in the upstairs, the substantial universals there, the kinds, substantial kind universals. They have many names. And here we have properties, or properties and relations, which would be the non-substantial universals. And these are supposed to be Aristotelian universals. I'm going to say a little bit more about that, relating to what Francesca was talking about, in fact, but not too much. I'm not going to be talking about tropes or modes and substances today, really, but in Lo's picture, they, of course, are important. So substantial universals is what we're interested in. And the relationship here, which Lo calls characterization, so the properties and relations they characterize the universals. That's the sort of relationship that I'm interested in here. But I think we can say much more about it than just use this formal ontological relation of characterization. And I'll try to do that as I go on. Good. Okay, so the question, what is the relationship between natural kinds and their properties? Well, this is not a question that only people like Lowe have been interested in. This is a question for everyone who's interested in natural kinds. So it was central already in John Stuart Mill's classic discussion of natural kinds in the 1800s. And for Mill, it was indeed important that we can distinguish between the genuine natural kinds and just groups of objects that are characterized by some shared natural property or several properties. So chemical substances might be a plausible candidate for a genuine natural kind, but being acidic, perhaps not so much, certainly not something like being green and round. That seems just bringing together a couple of properties. They might be natural properties, greenness and roundness, or perhaps not even natural properties, but let's assume they're natural properties. We can gather all these green and round things together, but that doesn't make them a natural kind. They're just sharing some properties, and we're classifying, perhaps arbitrarily, things together based on these shared properties. So we need this distinction. This is the motivation. We need this distinction between just a jumbled together group of objects that may share one or more properties and genuine natural kinds. Now, certainly you need this sort of distinction if you think that natural kinds are a genuine fundamental category. All right. So here's another example, perhaps a little bit more scientific. So take a unit vector of charge, a certain rest mass, and a half integer spin. Well, they characterize all electrons, presumably. But there isn't a similar relationship between greenness and roundness or all green and round things. So the clustering of the natural properties here is, in the case of electrons, is surely somehow more systematic or more robust than it is in the case of the green and round things. Similarly, you might consider electrons and muons. Well, they have the same charge, right, and half integer spin, but they have a different rest mass. Muons are considered to be heavier, I believe. But they're both leptons, right? So you can characterize them together and classify them together as leptons, but we wouldn't want to say that they are fundamentally of the same kind. So when we ask about these sort of natural kind distinctions, ultimately we're considering the narrowest kind. So you'd want to say that you can distinguish muons and electrons even if they share some of these properties, and you can classify them together for certain purposes, and it's useful to do so. But they are of two different kinds. Okay. So that would be required if we want to give necessary and sufficient conditions for kind range. Well, there's lots more to be said about this area, but we can talk about it more later on if you like. I want to push on so that I get through all of this. Okay, so shared properties, not sufficient for shared kind membership. And that's the key thought, I think, that motivates, prima facie at least, the distinction between kinds and their properties. So we need to know which clusters of properties are the genuine kinds. My view on this is that the properties that are clustered together in members of natural kinds do so because they are members of natural kinds. So the kinds are prior to their properties. That's the suggestion here. So the kinds, if you like, speaking a bit loosely, they do some work bringing together these properties. The kinds explain why these properties are clustered in this way. How do they do that? Well, that's something that I'm going to want to say a little bit more about. Now, take this concept, though, as a placeholder for what's doing the unifying. So there's going to be some sort of a method, what I call a method of unification, that brings together these properties. And there could be several different kinds of methods of unification. And I take it that a lot of the literature on natural kinds is actually interested in trying to specify a suitably robust method of unification. So take the homeostatic property cluster theory, famous from Boyd's work. Now, that gives you a method of unification, namely the lower level causal mechanism that brings together these higher order properties. But of course, Boyd applies this specifically to the case of biological kinds, and it may work fairly well in that context. But we know that it doesn't work quite so nicely in the case of, certainly not in the case of fundamental physical kinds, because there's no lower level mechanism that we can resort to explain the unification of, say, the shared properties among all electrons. There's no causal mechanism, it appears at least, that brings together unit negative charge and half-electron spin and so on. So if there's something that brings them together, it will be something else than what the HPC theory suggests, it would seem. But that doesn't mean that we couldn't classify the HPC theory as one perhaps promising way of explaining the method of unification for some kinds, namely biological kinds, perhaps. And there are others, many other suggestions. I'm not so interested in trying to list all these different methods of unification, but rather answering a more general question about what it means for a kind to unify its properties. All right. One more clarification before I get to the next part of the talk. And this concerns instantiation and the status of the universals. I don't want to talk about this in any detail, but I do understand the universals as Aristotelian instead of Platonic, although we've had a little bit of a discussion about whether Lowe was a Platonist or not. Thankfully, Francesca has already explained the details to you, so I don't have to go into them. The thought here is just that the instantiated universals are multi-located where their members are. But there are obvious problems that emerge right away. What about kinds that have no actual members? So take those transuranic elements that I'm going to talk about a little bit more later on, Einsteinium. It seems that it's a natural kind, a very good candidate for one, but it didn't exist before we synthesized it, right? Strictly speaking, in those cases, as a near Aristotelian, I want to say that the kinds do not exist unless their members do, because you do need these universals to be instantiated. They're not in a Platonic heaven. You do need them to be instantiated in the world. But that doesn't mean that we couldn't state, in a lot of cases, the identity conditions for the members of the kind. So we can say, were an entity of kind K, say, a certain transuranic element to come into existence, it would have such and such properties because it is a member of kind K. I have a more full-blown explanation of how we can talk about these sort of cases, and the explanation will be essentialist. But I'm going to set this aside, and it's something that we can talk about a little more if you like later on. But strictly speaking, this is something that the Aristotelian may struggle a little bit with, and indeed a reason why Francesca was worried about this. Okay. Good. So that's the first part done. Now you know my sort of basic framework for natural kinds. So I want to go into a little bit more detail about what it means for kinds to be mind independent, what it means for them to carve reality at its joints. So I've said back in 2015 that natural kinds reflect natural divisions in mind independent reality. Now this is a pretty common thing to say for realists about natural kinds, using this sort of mind independence criterion. But there are problematic cases, supposed cases of mind-dependent kinds, and some of those cases, at least, seem to be cases where we want to say that there is a genuine natural kind here, but it's not mind-independent. Now, take again Einsteinium, which is a transuranic element that we've synthesized. It's non-naturally occurring, right? I think it's atomic number 99, if I'm not mistaken. Another example, psychological kinds, such as depression. Surely, depression doesn't exist unless there are people who are depressed. If there weren't any human minds around, we wouldn't seem to have depression around. Or alien minds, if you like. Social kinds, such as money, are, of course, notoriously problematic. We need some sort of theory, economics, and social agreement about money before it comes into existence. So they're mind-dependent by definition, even, these sort of psychological and certain social kinds. Now, you could, of course, just be an anti-realist about those sort of higher order kinds because they aren't mind-dependent. But certainly, kinds like Einsteinium, you would, in most realist theories, natural kinds, you would want to include them. So we have to say a little bit more about how we understand this mind-independence criterion, if it is to be used here. Well, my understanding of the criterion is not very strict, actually. I think that all we need is a criterion that prevents purely conventional kinds, so arbitrary groupings of things, something like the green and round things that I mentioned, or, I don't know, Grudman's grew, or something like this. So That's what we need to rule out, but how do we do it exactly? Well, I'll give you an example of a clearly mind-dependent kind that I just made up when I was writing this paper. So I call them Cornwall rocks, or sea rocks for short. So this is my rock collection, which is based on a very loose set of aesthetic properties, such as relative roundness and a reddish hue. But they're not necessary. So the rocks need to be only round or reddish. So they could be green and rectangular, green and round, or rectangular and red or reddish or something like that. The only necessary property that these kinds have is that the rocks have been picked up on a certain beach in Cornwall. Now, I stress I don't actually have this rock collection, but I could have such a rock collection. That's the only sort of necessary property for this grouping of kinds. So it's a little bit like the green and round things. I've just decided to collect these rocks that have these sort of properties. Now, who thinks that the sea rocks are a natural kind? Hands up. No one. Yes. Very good. That's what I mean. So we want to rule out some things as natural kinds, but clearly they can have some shared properties. And Muhammad Ali Khalidi has helpfully listed some criteria for the mind independence of kinds. This is a 2016 paper that we recently read in the Metascience Reading Group. So he lists four different ways to understand the mind independence criteria. I'm just going to quickly go through them. So first of them, mind dependence of a kind versus its instances. So it's pretty clear that the Einsteinium case goes through on this one, because any instance of Einsteinium is of course independent of the minds, even if we took our creation to create a kind. Oh, I'm getting mixed up. I mean the other way around. The kind itself is independent, even if any and all instances of Einsteinium have to be created in a lab or something like this. The kind itself could still be minded. Well, it's a little bit more complicated with this Aristotelian picture, of course, because you need the kind to exist to have, or its instances to exist to have the kind there. But strictly speaking, the identity conditions of the kind are, of course, mind independent. But certain psychological kinds, of course, wouldn't qualify. Any instance of depression is going to be dependent on minds, but also the depression kind in general is dependent on minds. So that might be one way to go. Here's another one, causal versus constitutive mind dependence. So we need to causally create these instances of transuranic elements, perhaps, but they're not constituted by anything that's dependent on human minds, right? They're constituted by electrons and protons and so on. So constitutively, they are mind independent. So that might be another way to go here. But again, social kinds or psychological kinds could perhaps be ruled out on this sort of criterion. The third one is contingent versus necessary mind dependence. So the case of psychological kinds would be an instance of necessary mind dependence. You couldn't have the kind without the human minds. Here it's a little bit trickier to deal with the transuranic elements case, but at least in principle we could conceive of them coming into existence without our influence. So if the conditions were right in the world, they could come into existence in some sort of natural reactor or something like this. I mean, some of these kinds do come into existence like this, some of the transuranic elements. So you can kind of see that this sort of criterion might also work. All of these have problems, right? The fourth one is mind dependence versus theory dependence. So this is the thought that at least many social kinds, such as money, depend on a theory, i.e. economics. So we need a theory for the kind to even come into existence, whereas we certainly do not need a theory of chemistry or physics or whatever for the transuranic kinds to come into existence. Okay, but all of these are problematic, and Khalidi actually rules out all of these cases. I'm not going to go into the details, but I agree with him that they are problematic, right? So he proposes a fifth formulation, which is a bit better, perhaps. Mental sustenance versus initial manifestation. Okay, so the social kinds, the psychological kinds, they need our active sustenance to exist, right? So they're mind dependent in that sort of sense as well. Whereas something like a transuranic element, well, it just needs our initial push. We need to create it. But once it's there, it doesn't need any active contribution from human minds to exist. Well, okay, they might exist very briefly because they have very short half-lives, but nevertheless, they exist without our active contribution. But the psychological kinds obviously wouldn't if they're dependent on actively someone having depression or whatever. Okay, so he thinks that this is a little bit better. You can make the distinction between these sort of supposedly problematic social or psychological kinds, and you can include things like Einsteinium, but he doesn't ultimately think that this is going to do the trick that the realist about natural kinds wants. So he says that while it does provide a way to distinguish these cases, it doesn't provide any good ontological account for distinguishing real or genuine kinds from ersatz kinds. So he says, and I agree with him on this, the problematic kinds, so he mentions something like fairies, but think of sea rocks. The problematic kinds do not cease to be when there are no human minds to sustain them, because they were never real kinds to begin with. And that seems right. So he says, there are no instantiations of such kinds because there is nothing in reality that would correspond to the specifications or characteristics that members of those kinds are posited to have. So they do not carve at the joints. So hence, they're not real kinds. Now, so far, I agree with Khalidi. But obviously, if you say something like this, you better have some sort of criteria for the reality of kinds in mind. You have to be able to distinguish fairies from Einsteinium. And indeed spurious kinds from genuine kinds. So that's what we're looking for here. And the mind independence criterion, Khalidi thinks, is not a good way of getting there, but I actually disagree with that if we understand the mind independence criterion correctly. So I'm going to put Khalidi into some trouble here because his criterion of reality is, I think, unsatisfactory. He defends, and this is one reason why I choose Khalidi's theory, he defends a very common way of going about this. So what he calls a causal criterion of reality for kinds. So this just amounts to the idea, without going into details, that natural kinds are clusters of causal properties, or as he calls it, them nodes and causal networks. He's a 2018 paper where he specifies his theory further. Now, what are these nodes and causal networks? Well, they're things that we can tie into prediction or to use the technical word, projectability. And projectability is a very popular choice among people who try to get to the bottom of natural kinds. So here's Kim saying that a projectable law, well, it needs to have the ability to be confirmed by observation of positive instances. And laws and kinds go hand in hand in a lot of these theories, like in Fodor's theory, for instance. So Kim, of course, doesn't think that there are these high-level kinds. He says psychological states, for instance, they aren't projectable, because there are no special science laws concerning them, and Fodor would insist that Kim is wrong here. Pain, for instance, and beliefs that P, if they express real states about which all the available evidence suggests that there are real laws, well, then they are projectable in the relevant sense, or so it would seem. So this is just to give you the context that this discussion goes back into this old literature. I'm happy to talk more about it. I've got views about the Kim Fodor debate as well. But I want to give you the details from Khalidi himself. And here's a longer quotation from his paper. He says, "If I want to know whether there is a real kind fairy, I am primarily concerned with the question as to whether there is a group of individuals, all of whom share such properties as smaller stature relative to humans, area of flight, disposition to live in woodlands." I didn't know that fairies have this sort of disposition, but anyway, ability to perform magic and so on. They may not all have the exact same set of causal properties, just like we would want to say in a theory of natural kinds, but there must be enough similarity among them to participate in the same or similar causal processes. Accordingly, the categories that correspond to these kinds are projectable, they feature in inductive inferences, and figure in scientific explanations, whether in the natural or social sciences. Now, of course, fairies do not none of these things, according to Khalidi. So they're not a genuine kind. What we need for a genuine kind is to be projectable, feature inductive inferences, figure in scientific explanations, perhaps. That might not be necessary, but typically they do. That's why we need these notions. So fairies don't classify as a natural kind, according to this idea. Why? Well, because if the kind can be conjured by the mind, willy-nilly, well, then we would be in trouble. So sea rocks would qualify if the fairies qualify. So the issue here is quite simply that you can predict some things based on the properties of these kinds, right? You can predict some things about the sea rocks. Namely, you can take a rock from this beach in Cornwall and say, ah, Toby's taking a walk there. He sees this reddish round rock and says, well, this would be splendid in Thomas's collection. And if I bring this to him, he's going to thank me and buy me a beer. And I will do that, Toby, if you bring me a reddish round rock. So that would be an instance of projectability, it seems. Indeed, there's a law. If you bring me a reddish round rock, I will buy you a beer. Well, let's not call it a law. I might get in trouble here. But anyway, you could see that this sort of behavior could become quite frequent. I mean, any old guy who's starting to bring me loads and loads of rocks from this beach is going to get a beer from me. So if this practice becomes frequent enough, if the notion of a sea rock becomes entrenched in among the Cornwall drunkards who bring me these rocks for beer, I don't know, I'm just making this stuff up. But you see where I'm going with this. That's not gonna do. So Khalidi is of course aware of this sort of problem, and he tackles it head on. So take a couple of cases, maybe a little bit better than my sea rocks. The cases of race, a social kind, we assume that race doesn't have a biological basis, right? And the case of witch. Okay. So Khalidi thinks that actually witch or witches, they were a real kind, a real social kind back in the day, because there was a very systematic oppression of certain women who shared perhaps some sort of properties. Now, obviously, nothing supernatural was going on here. It was more based on a certain kind of discriminatory practice. Now, exactly the same way as race is used to discriminate people, unfortunately. Now, that doesn't mean that race has any sort of a biological basis, but it just means that there are some, as it were, social laws about how people behave when confronted by people of a certain race or something like this. Now, what those laws are, don't ask me, but, you know, social scientists might be able to tell you a little bit more about this. Now, witches cease to be a real kind. And Khalidi says, in the same way, race could cease to be a real kind in a post-racial society where people are no longer discriminated because of their race. Let's hope that we get there. But at the time of writing, race is a real social kind. Now, is this the result that we wanted? It's not the result that I wanted. It seems fairly spurious. It seems that the difference to sea rocks, between sea rocks and the difference between some supposedly real kind, like witch or race, is not particularly well defined here. Because I've just given you all these laws and all these causal predictions about the sea rock kind. Now, Khalidi does have an answer to this question, but I'm not satisfied by it. He says, so what exactly is the difference? He says, the difference would seem to be based on how widespread the effects are and how robust, long-lasting, and entrenched the causal profile. If the category in question only affects the behavior of a single person, leading to minimal social influence, then there is little reason to regard it as a social kind. So if it's just Toby who carries these red rocks to me, that's not going to be enough, right? But if all the people in Cornwall start doing it, well, I mean, maybe that's enough. So maybe sea rocks on this criteria could become a real kind. The social phenomena associated with them, at any rate. Now, questions. What is widespread enough? How robust do these things need to be? How long-lasting? How entrenched the causal profile needs to be? These are open questions. And the move that Khalidi makes here, appealing to the entrenchment of a natural kind, well, that's a move that has been tried before, and I think it's been similarly unsuccessful before. So take tooth fairies. There's another kind. Tooth fairies, I think, are a real social kind on this criteria, because children know that if they put their loose teeth, well, probably not just the loose teeth, the teeth that actually fell out, under their pillows, money will appear. I mean, very real causal effects. You can buy candy with your fallen teeth, and maybe more of them will fall out. So you can certainly make predictions about the sort of social phenomena associated with the belief in tooth fairies. And there's probably enough children that believe in them, even if it's not quite as predominant as the Santa Claus, which also would qualify as a real kind, by the way, in this criteria. But I don't want Santa Claus and tooth fairies to be real kinds, if that wasn't clear enough yet. Okay, good. So I think that we're getting... I mean, this has been a long-winded example, I admit that. But we're getting to the core of what I think is important to get here, which is the role of the unification method for the kinds. And it's that method of unification that needs to be mind-independent, I think, for us to get to the genuine kinds. So that's what the criteria for reality of natural kinds really amounts to. And the HPC theory is actually a good example of this. Because it does give us an objective mechanism, a causal mechanism that serves to unify these kinds. So that would be a fine example of a method of unification. Whereas what I've just told you about Xerox, or indeed I think the witches or race, the method of unification here seems to be totally arbitrary. It just happens to be that people are discriminated based on certain properties. But, you know, they could just as well be discriminated because they, I don't know, wear glasses, or because their hair is ginger, right? Or because they've got a slight tilt to the left when they walk. Or, I mean, make up your own examples. This is easy to do. And I don't want these things to be genuine kinds. Okay, so here's one difference that we can actually track. The cases that I've discussed here, they seem to lack a certain kind of robustness, namely counterfactual robustness. So the tooth fairy case would be a case in point, because tooth fairies, by my understanding, could have had a very different set of profile, set of causal features. You know, they could have it could have been the case that instead of you getting money for your teeth under your pillow, you get candy or whatever. I mean, maybe people do that anyway. I have no idea. But the point is that there's no reason why we couldn't change the causal profile associated with these sort of kinds. But we can't do that when there's an objective method of unification, at least not so easily. So there's a certain amount of robustness there. Now, I want to give an example where I think this actually makes a difference. So take a psychological kind like depression. Now, depression is defined in the DSM-5 based on a set of psychological and somatic symptoms. I think they list 8 symptoms. Two of those symptoms are depressed mood and loss of interest or pleasure. There's other things such as suicidal thoughts and so on. Depression, it does perhaps seem to lack an objective method of unification, just like I've been insisting here, because it's just defined in the basis of these symptoms as opposed to their causes. In fact, the DSM-5 specifies that these symptoms shouldn't be caused by some sort of substance abuse or some other medical condition. So depression gives you these symptoms without a specific medical cause, like, I don't know what it might be. But in any case, that is specified here. So there's an element of arbitrariness here. In order to be diagnosed with depression, for one thing, the individual should be experiencing at least 5 of those 8 symptoms, and 2 of them have to be these depressed mood or loss of interest or pleasure. It has to be a 2-week period as well. So a little bit of arbitrariness here, and I think for a good reason. The reason is we don't really know all the causes of depression, right? I wish we did, but it's a difficult condition to diagnose. Okay, I should push on because I'm kind of getting late on this. Right, so it could be the case that there is no objective method of unification of depression, so that it's like, I think, race and witch are, or sea kinds, or it could be that there's a narrower kind that underlies some of these symptoms, and we just don't know what it is, so we don't know the method of unification. And I take it that when we study depression, we're trying to figure out, some of the time, whether there is a deeper cause to some of these symptoms or not. So at the time of writing, I think that we should be agnostic about whether depression is a real kind or not, because we don't know whether there is an objective method of unification or not, or whether it's just a bunch of symptoms that are do occur together in very many cases, but perhaps they have different causes in different cases, and actually there would be narrower kinds that we should be focusing on. Maybe depression 1, depression 2, depression 3, which are genuine kinds, but they are jumbled together into depression all around, something like this. Now, obviously, I don't know much about depression to be making these sort of claims, but this is the general thought. Good. Okay, so that's the example done here, and I'm not now going to run through the last part of the talk much too quickly. Sorry about that, but we can talk about this a little bit more. So what I'm interested in is not finding out the specific method of unification for these cases. I mean, that's an interesting study, and we should do that empirically and with the sciences. But I'm interested in the, if you like, the why of unification rather than the how. So not how the method of unification is fulfilled in a certain case, but rather why should we be looking for these cases in the first place. And this brings me back to the formal ontological framework that I'm interested in. So I got a little quote here from David Homan from a forthcoming paper where he talks about these neo-Aristotelian kind universal. And he says, kinds represent unified ways of being, both in an individual and a collective sense. They account for the modal and the temporal stability of character, both within single particular objects and across what we call different members of the same kind. So this is the thought that I'm sort of building towards. So the kinds are prior to their properties, and they do the unification here. You can compare this with David Orderberg's unity problem, or indeed the problem of propria in the Neo-Aristotelian literature. So there's an essence or a group, set bundle of properties. What holds those properties together for the natural kinds? Well, there should be some sort of unifying element, and we should be able to distinguish what a K is, such as to distinguish Ks from every other kind of thing. This is just to show that this problem has been discussed in the literature. So here's another quote from Homan. He says, humankind, it can maybe be defined or characterized in terms of its essential attributes, whatever they are, but it's one's being human which grounds one's having these characteristics, such as capacity for humor, to use the classic example. Not the other way around. So kinds represent these unified ways of being. Good. So that's all there. Well, here's Orderberg saying just the same thing. Having a capacity for humor is maybe an essential property of human beings, and it flows from the essence of human beings to have that capacity, but the essence of being human is to be a rational animal, never mind the example, and humans have that capacity for humor only because they are rational animals. Okay, so it flows from the essence somehow. Now, Orderberg uses this old-fashioned notion of flow, and it just means that something is coming from the essence of a particular object belonging to a given kind. Well, these things are caused by and they originate in the form of that kind. But I think that's misleading because there's no causation necessarily going on here. So how exactly is this picture supposed to work? Well, it's based on hylomorphism. We heard a little bit about this when Francesca was giving her talk as well. But my picture is not hylomorphist, and indeed I agree with Lowe's critical remarks about it. So here's what he says. On this sort of hylomorphic picture, an individual substance possesses a certain form, which constitutes its essence, from which flow by necessity certain features of the substance, which are its properties in the strictest sense of the term. But I think we should identify the form with the essence. I've got more to say about that as well. What I'm really interested in is this one, this quote from Lowe. So he says, the form doesn't, in any sense that I can understand, and indeed in any sense that I can understand, combine with the proton and the electron, this is discussing the case of hydrogen, as to constitute together with them the atom. The only things that do any combining here are the proton and the electron, where the former captures the latter and the latter occupies an orbital around the former. So only things that constitute the atom are the proton and the electron, which are its parts in a perfectly familiar sense of part. So there's no hylomorphism involved in this sort of picture. Good. I should really be wrapping up, right? 40. Did I start at 3? Yeah. I'll try to finish this, just a couple of slides. I'm not going to try to give a very full picture about this anyway. My Finnish colleagues have actually seen the resulting picture in another form, and I should thank Jani for clarifying a couple of things about it. But I'm going to use in the sort of fuller, in the fullness of time, when you're going to develop this type of theory of how natural kinds unify their properties, I think we have to use ontological dependence relations, and this ties us back to formal ontology. So specifically rigid and generic dependence relations. So if you're not familiar with them, I don't really have time to get into the details of here. So I think I'm just going to skip to the final picture, which is much more informative than the textual versions of these anyway. But the point is here that there can be these symmetric and or asymmetric dependence relations, and we need asymmetric relations in the case in point. So take something like charge. Well, it essentially depends for its existence, it seems, on there being some kind on the Sarrestrichian picture, such as electrons, that have that property of charge. So you don't have charge without it being instantiated in electrons, or indeed some other kind, like muons, or what have you. So there seems to be a dependence going that way around. And there's also an asymmetric dependence relation between the general kind essence of electrons and the essential properties that the kind unifies. That's the thought here. But rather than reading this text out, I'm going to show you the picture, because that's much more informative for this anyway. So take your kind K, say electron, and take the essential properties of that kind. We've got our charge, and we've got our mass, and we've got our spin, presumably. There's going to be some sort of dependence relation running, it's controversial which way around we want these arrows to be drawn, but there's going to be a rigid dependence relation, perhaps identity dependence, running from the kind to the essential properties. We don't have that sort of a kind unless it's being characterized by these sort of properties. But there's another dependence relation running the other way, of course, here. Also an asymmetric dependence relation, because you don't have these properties unless they're instantiated and members of a certain kind. But of course, we can have properties. The electron is not a good example here, but we can have properties that are just accidental for a kind as well. So we need to build those into the picture also. So I don't know what would be a great example here, but if you think that there are biological kinds, then certainly they have properties that are just accidental to them rather than essential. So tigers can have three or four legs, so their four-leggedness is an accidental property of them. So these sort of properties also will depend on the kind. They somehow, if you use Otterberg's term, flow from the kind, but there's no causation involved here, because you can formulate all of these things just by using these simple dependence relations, ontological dependence relations. So that's the resulting picture, and I've already overrun my time, so I better stop here. Sorry for rushing through the last bit, but I'm happy to talk about it all. Thank you.